Hello, and welcome to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Shake. You guys, it's Friday. It has been a long freaking week, and I can't wait for this just thing to be over, this night day to be over. It's just, I'm exhausted, is what I'm trying to get at. I'm very excited about my guest today. He's been a homie for a long time, and more than being a homie, he was one of the original Axis of Evil comedy tour stars. And since then, he has done a lot of other really big stuff, and we're going to talk about it. Here is my very talented friend, Aaron Cater. How are you?
You're yes, muted. But... that's me. Yeah, well, I had to unmute because I'm not away from these midgets yet, so almost. And but yeah, this is a rough hour right now.
Are you daddy sitting and you're doing this with me?
You know, I kept saying to people, like, oh, I'm always stuck babysitting and, during the pandemic and the quarantine. And then a cousin of mine was like, you know, if they're your kids, you don't call that babysitting. You call that parenting.
We don't call that parenting. It's called parenting.
You babysit other kids. You parent your own kids.
That tells you, Aaron, that I don't have kids. That's what that tells you.
I know. I mean, look, I'm not, it's not a contest to see who has it harder, but when you were like, it's been the worst, I'm like, that's common. But I in my head, I was like, wait, you don't have no kids? How hard is it?
Listen, what? I would never ever compare my struggles to yours. No freaking way. You no. Hands down beat me all day, every day.
It's not that. It's just that, like, man, having the kids, during this, you know, no school, no babysitters, you know, you can't just go and hire somebody.
Yes, that's a lot.
No daycare. I'm a member over at this YMCA, and they'll let you drop the kids in this room for a couple hours.
Yeah, I see you got, now you have two kids. How old are they?
Yeah, the five-year-old the other boy is one. He was born in June, so he turned one through the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so one turned five in just in November last month, and the other's one. And
Time I saw you, your wife was pregnant with the son.
That's, oh, okay. But,
yeah, so it's been a little over a year that we haven't spoken or seen each other.
Yep, that's true. Actually, I remember, I was having flashbacks, actually, of driving down to Orange County and doing your show.
Yeah, I've tortured you a couple of times, and you've been a real trooper about it, so I appreciate you, man. Do you need a minute to kind of put things, to give things to the kiddos, or what?
Yeah,
let
me just finish this, and I'm going to set it on the oven and then walk away.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to remove you off the stream, so you take care, and you just wave at me when you're ready, and we'll bring you back on.
I'm almost there. Okay. I just got one.
Actually, I'm kind of enjoying this, Aaron, because I'm like almost like getting educated watching you.
Yeah?
Like in parenting. So I'm not planning on having any kids, but, you know, maybe I'll adopt a kid or two, but.
You never know. Well, my wife has been working. She started a business right before this whole thing started.
Oh wow! What's her business?
Sorry.
What's her business?
Oh, she does lips, eyes, injection, Botox.
Oh wow!
Like an aesthetic clinic.
Oh my God! I'm so gonna be her best friend. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. You should. I mean, obviously you're down there and stuff, but it's in the valley here.
Yeah, you're in the valley, right?
Yeah, we moved up to Northridge. It's very nice, very suburban. The schools are very good. Everything's very good.
Yeah, it's very nice.
But yeah, it's been so she's like getting this business going and started, and you know I can't work, and so all of a sudden she's I'm stay-at-home dad guy, and I'm like, it's fine a few days a week, but not fucking 6 days a week.
That's a lot, man. That is a lot.
I'm gonna call child services on myself.
No, please don't do that. I think you're. It seems like you're doing a good job.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how if they. I mean, look. The worst case scenario is the kids turn out to be cannibal cannibal murderers. That's the worst.
That's the absolute worst. Or school shooters, because that's a big thing in America, school shooting.
Yeah, anything other than shooter or, what do you call it, cannibal, you know, is fine.
But, you know, I really doubt it, though, because your wife is Lebanese, isn't she?
She is Lebanese, yes.
Yeah, she's Lebanese. I remember that. Nah, man, there's no way. Brown people's kids don't turn out to be that. There's just no way.
Well, yeah, but she's not exactly raising them, is she?
She's partially raising them.
She's letting a psychopath raise their kids. all right, I'm done. I'm gonna come and sit with you now.
Is your kid having a lollipop in her diapers? Is that what's happening there?
Oh, that this is right here? So that is she so actually cute. She's not wearing anything, so I shouldn't put her on camera, but she was eating a popsicle, which I didn't say no to. I was like, she asked for it, and I'm like, just take whatever the fuck you want. Just, you want a popsicle, you want a fucking cookie, you want ice cream, whatever the fuck you want. For breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whatever you want. Like, whatever I'm like, you want. I can't do this anymore.
Where's the one-year-old baby? Is he sleeping?
Oh, yeah, you want to see him?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious what, like, kids must be beautiful because they're like, you know, got all a mix of all those amazing genes.
All right, I'll put Nora on her face real quick. And then, cousin Susie just got here. Let me see without putting Susie on.
Oh, hello, cousin Susie. Well, hello. Oh, my goodness. What's his name?
Omar. What's his name?
He's so cute. Oh, my God. What a beauty. Good job there.
Omar. Yeah, he is actually very cute. And this girl,
His name is Omar?
Omar.
Oh. No, hi, cutie patootie. Oh, my goodness. You're a little mom. Oh, my goodness. That's cute.
My name's Nora.
Hi, Nora. I feel responsible as an aunt to almost edit that part out because I want to, like, protect her. This, like, my protective instincts just came in. I was like, no, put a shirt on her.
Yeah, you mean don't throw her on some internet tattoo that's got her child with no pants.
There's a lot of sickos out there, and so I just get very protective. That's all.
They can't be trusted. People can't be trusted. But listen, Nora is on the spectrum. She is just slightly on the spectrum. We don't know what to do with her. Like, we got her assessed when she was like two and a half.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like, it's autism, you know, it's autism. It's what it is. Mm-hmm.
Like when, yeah. And how much on the spectrum is she? Like what, I mean, is it, she had like some kind of learning thing going on?
The sign was that it was a speech delay. She wasn't talking. She wasn't like, we'd say mom, say dad. And she just wouldn't, she had this weird block. So yeah, a couple of years, you know, by two and a half, you can kind of figure out like milestones that they're either meeting or not meeting. And yeah. But yeah, it's a spectrum, but they don't tell you like right here is red and over here is blue, and then somewhere in between is where, you know, like they don't tell you exactly where on the spectrum your kid is. It's just a spectrum. She's not an extreme case. But if you talk to her, you see her, you wouldn't really notice. It would take you a couple hours to go, oh yeah, she's kind of weird, you know.
Oh, probably not weird. Poor baby.
No, but the truth is, like, nowadays we know a lot more than we used to. When you and I were growing up,
sure.
I mean, there was a kid that had Tourette's in like fourth grade, but we just called it a tick.
Right, you call it a tick. You said that the person was being lazy, or they just didn't pay attention. Right, there were all these labels for these kids.
Yeah, and now we know that those are actual things. You know, so like
right. That's right.
You know, it's ADD is the typical. You know, I'm ADD, but women actually are misdiagnosed more often. Really? Boys, really? Immediately, they're like, he's ADD, give him Ritalin, give him Adderall. But girls, when they have ADD symptoms, they go, she's got too much anxiety, and they give you something else. They never give girls the Adderall and the Ritalin like they do with boys for some reason.
I didn't know that. Is that a like statistical fact?
It's been pretty, pretty, it's kind of a new, a new what do you call it observation that they were like, wow, we've been misdiagnosed. Because like, so what happens is these girls go through the life, and then when they're adults and they're on their own and they're in their 20s and they get a doctor, they find out that Adderall or Ritalin or whatever works for them, and they're like, shit, I should have been on this my whole life.
Right, right, absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I've had other, I mean, I've been in therapy for like 13 years, so that has like single-handedly saved me. But I've never been told that I'm like on the, but I definitely have some other stuff that I had to, have been kind of dealing with, you know. I have bouts of rages that I get into. I have this rage that I get into, so I'm working on my rage.
I can relate to anger. Anger is a big problem.
I thought you would be, because, you know, I feel like stand-up comics in general kind of have, they always have like this level of temper that's always simmering. It's always on simmer. You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Then depending on the situation, it just turns the fuck up. Depends on what you're triggered by, or depends on what you said what. Are you taking walk? What are you doing?
I'm sorry. I was trying. God damn it. I'm trying to avoid the kids. See, they follow me. Now they're outside. See, and this is the thing. They can't be outside. You got to get inside, North. No, come on.
Stop.
Oy, oy. Come on,
stop.
No, North.
What?
Uh-oh.
I will step on her fingers and laugh, and I will just say no, and she'll cry. I don't care anymore. I'm going to go to a different spot.
Can you sit in your bedroom and shut the door? Is that possible?
Well, she can't just, like, go outside. I'm not going to sit there with her.
Well, Auntie Susie's there, right? Auntie Susie's there to help out?
Yeah, Susie's trying to get this baby to sleep. She's got her hands full with it. So that's the thing. It's one thing to have one kid, but to have two.
Yeah.
And to have one be a baby that constantly needs you.
Yeah, it's a lot.
By the way, I could have very easily grabbed my laptop for this, but I all of a sudden I was cooking dinner and it got sped up on me here. But anyway, back to your thing.
You're doing so many adult things, Aaron. It's almost like I can't even relate.
No, I mean, yeah, that's the thing is like,
I'm a single girl that lives with a 5-year-old pit bull. Like, that's my life.
When I was not with kids and all the friends that had kids, I was like, oh, yeah, they got kids. You know, I was always kind of like, I wouldn't say envious, but I was like, I thought it was pretty impressive because I never thought I would do that, you know?
Yeah. You know, you never thought that you would become a dad and have kids?
No.
Really?
Well, I did like most of my life, but then somewhere between 27-ish and 35-ish.
Yeah.
I was like, it took about 2 or 3 years. And then I was like, you know, I should just get used to the idea that maybe no, maybe not. Maybe I'm not. That's not going to happen. Like, that's not so bad. Like, why do I have this thing in my head that I'm supposed to have that? I don't want that necessarily. Right. And then, and then it went full circle and I realized, no, actually I do want that because I'm not good if I'm just left alone all the time.
I think that might be the case for me too, Aaron. I don't think it might. I don't think it's a good idea that I'm left alone. Are you moving around? Cause I'm losing you now. Aaron, there you are. Yeah. Your reception is now getting a little choppy.
I'm going to turn off my Wi-Fi because it's actually worse.
Yeah. When you're just like on your mobile reception, it's probably better. So,
okay, you tell me when it's working.
Yeah, it's getting a little staticky.
Refresh. Okay, now we should be all set.
I can hear you, but your voice, your image is getting a little choppy. Before it was all very smooth and... You know, Aaron, I was researching, because I like to research my guests, and I didn't realize, I knew that your mom was, is Mormon, and your dad, I didn't realize that your grandfather is the one who moved from Palestine back in 1912.
And
so you're like second generation, right? Second generation? Or third?
Yeah, actually, I grew up thinking of myself as a third generation, but I'm second generation born in the U.S., but I'm third generation in the sense that my grandfather, he came to this country and became an American. So I'm a third generation American, but yeah. I'm only the second generation actually born in America.
That's right. That's right. Because I was watching your dad and I was like, dude, your dad speaks with like a perfectly American accent. How is that possible? Oh. And I was like, oh, because your grandfather came here. So your dad is born and raised here. That's why he sounds completely. And you grew up in a LDS church. What is LDS church, Aaron?
Mormons. The Mormons.
The Mormon church.
Yeah, the Mormons is the LDS.
Man, can I tell you something? I went to Utah last year. I was in Zion. First of all, beautiful. Utah's
Zion
beautiful.
National Park.
I went to Zion National Park, yeah. So I went to Zion. Just loved it. I actually am a big fan of Mormons, believe it or not. I think Mormons are really sweet people. I have had friends in New York that I grew up with were Mormons. I've met friends here who are Mormons, like sweetheart people. But Mormons and Muslims have a lot in common, which made sense to me when I heard about your parents getting married. And I was like, yeah, Mormons and Muslims, we have a lot in common. But you...
Yeah, it's true.
But you were raised primarily Mormon, though, right?
Yeah, so my dad was raised like in Provo on a farm. He was born in the 40s. His brothers, sisters were born in the 30s and 40s. Big family. And they were... My grandfather, when he got here, he ended up serving in World War I, and then they gave veterans, they gave him a piece of land in Utah.
Interesting. Piece of land.
Long story short, he ends up with a farm in Utah. And so my dad and everybody were raised, you know, in the 40s and 50s, like immigrants, Muslim Palestinians in Provo on cherries and cows and goats and chickens and, you know, on a farm. And there was no other Arabs around. There was not even a mosque.
Right. I can't even imagine. I mean, what brought your grandfather to America? I mean, we're talking, what, 1912? Like,
1912. Well, I mean, it makes sense that anybody was coming to America at that time, especially from Palestine. They knew the Ottoman Empire was not, you know, they were losing their grasp at that point already, especially in that region. You know, they still had control of it, but they didn't really have control. I mean, the locals had control. So, I mean, that's a whole different history thing, but like, it's one thing, it makes sense to come to America, but how the fuck you end up in Utah? You know what I mean?
But Aaron, it's always like that though. You know, I meet Pakistanis, like I got flown out to Indiana to perform for these Pakistanis. And I was like, what the fuck are you guys doing in Indiana?
Yeah, I've driven through Kentucky and parts of Indiana too, where there's like these Pakistanis owning these little motels off Route 40 or something. And you're like, did you come all the way from the homeland to run a motel in Kentucky?
Yeah. What? Yeah, it's so weird. But, I mean, were you guys the only Palestinian family like in all of Provo, or was there like a tiny little Palestinian community somewhere?
No, there was my grandfather. He had a cousin who then left. And then that was it. So my dad, his sister, one of his brothers, they all married Mormons. They all went to BYU and grew up around there and married white people. And then one married white, but she wasn't Mormon. And another, only one brother actually married an Arab and stayed like Arab and raised his kids speaking Arabic and, you know, Muslim and everything else. But so my dad converted for my mom because like the culture didn't mean anything to him. It was like,
that's right.
He didn't even go back there till he was 18. And then when they took him back for they were there for like 3 months for the summer, and he realized they were arranging marriages for everybody. And so he had an uncle that was like, lent him money, and they were like, Omar, go and don't look back, you know? And like, he kind of ran away from the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, he very well could have married one of his cousins back home and had a great life.
That's what we do. By the way, is that a thing among Palestinians, like marrying your first cousins? Is that, do you guys do that?
Yeah, it's a thing.
It's a thing. I think it's a Muslim culture thing, isn't it, Eric? Because Pakistan is, we marry our first, we fuck our first cousins. It's gross.
Yeah, it's still a Muslim or an Arab thing, but it wasn't just Arabs and Muslims that did it. I mean, historically, everybody did it. I mean, you look at the British royal family, they still do it almost.
The royal family kinda still does it, right. Because they want to keep the power in the family. So they mix all their blood in and it's gross.
Kids are breaking the cycle now. But I mean, that shit went on for a long, long time. But first cousins, not necessarily all the time anymore. But it's still pretty common. It's acceptable.
Yeah. It is pretty acceptable. You know,
my grandparents were first cousins.
Yeah, say that again.
My dad's parents were first cousins.
Wow. But they didn't have any Muslims for Progressive Values saying, please say hi to Aaron for us. He hosted our celebration of life in 2018. MPV. Muslims for Progressive Values. Oh. Remember MPV?
Oh, are you talking to somebody? Are there people messaging, watching this?
Oh, yeah, I was just showing, the people are messaging.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're just commenting. You know, Aaron, you and I were just talking about your daughter being on the spectrum and me going to therapy for 13 years and all that. And I honestly, like, my biggest challenge has been rage. Like, I deal with a lot of rage that, you know, I've lived a pretty challenging life, so I think there's a lot of like rage that is tied into it. So like you were talking about, like, you've dealt with anger and rage. Like, did you go to therapy for it, or do you go to therapy for it?
Yeah, I wanted to get back to your rage too, because I don't know where yours comes from, and to be honest, I don't really know where mine comes from, because, you know, I have a brother that's very mild-mannered. Actually, two of my brothers are pretty patient people. One of them, you can't, he doesn't have a temper at all, really. And my younger brother is very steady, consistent. I'm inconsistent. I'm mercurial. But I've always said, like, people with a short fuse like me, that's what you want. You don't want somebody with a long fuse, because when the long fuse person blows up, there's a reason that the fuse was so long. You gotta have time to get the fuck away. You know what I mean? You want to be as far away as possible. But the short fuse guy, that's like a firecracker. That's less than a firecracker. It's constantly popping. It might be annoying, but it's not hurting anybody.
I think probably it doesn't maybe hurt anybody, but it hurts you probably, I would think, in relationships, you know, with business and maybe other friendships maybe.
Yeah, you know, I've thought that my anger probably got in the way. Nobody's ever said that, and nobody's ever been able to point to something that said, hey, your anger got in the way of something. It's more emotional, inner psychological. My anger frustrates me, and then I can't focus on what I should be focused on. So then I end up going, you know, I play basketball, or golf, or I'll just do something to work it out, but I'm not actually, doing the work that I maybe should be doing or something. I'm avoiding, you know. So a lot of that anger then leads to me avoiding and blah, blah, blah. So, and I've done, you know, a lot of the therapy, but then there was a point where I got depressed enough and empty enough to where I realized that I would rather have a secure relationship, a marriage, and a kid. I'd rather be puttering around here chasing kids than sitting around by myself going, fuck, my phone doesn't ring, I'm alone. I mean, it gets pretty isolating, you know. It does. Yeah. And I spent most of my life alone. I never wanted to be in relationships and stuff. I was always preferred to be alone, preferred to be single. And now I'm in a marriage and happily and with kids, and I still prefer to be alone.
You like you yeah. Because you're also a creative person, so you need that alone time, right?
Yeah, you're creative. You need to have outlets. Sorry, man, this thing is whistling over here.
What is that?
I can't find us. It's a goddamn fucking lottery, you piece of shit. Fucking motherfucker. It's going to explode. Inshallah, it's going to just take us all out.
Don't say that, Aaron. I'm sending that. I'm dialing 911 right now.
I can't go in here. I can't go over there. There's nowhere for me to go. You know
no,
what I mean?
You're fine.
Every fucking step I take, something's annoying the shit out of me.
No, you're fine. We're having a good conversation. Let's just keep going. No, this is
good
this
example
is-
about my anger. Just a minute ago, before I got on, I dropped a dish scrubber down the fucking sink hole, you know, where the garbage disposal is.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there fucking reaching for it like an asshole, like trying to fucking get it, and I can't. And right when I think I have it, it falls back in, and I'm like cursing this thing. I'm like, you fucking motherfucker, goddamn. You know, I'm getting all mad. And then I realize, oh, I could just get some tongs, and I got.
Well,
you know, it's like you just.
But that's what anger does, doesn't it? Like anger and rage, it just blinds you for like that moment. You're just like, all logic is out the door. Nothing matters. Fuck everything. Burn everything down. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, oh my God, I could have just used this one thing and then it could have been just resolved.
Exactly. But see, this is why I do like to be alone, because my anger is going to get in the way. But my anger is also the source of my creativity. The anger is such a source of all of my, because like I've had girlfriends in the past, when they saw my temper and they saw me get angry, they got afraid. And I'm like, I had to tell them, I'm like, the correct way to respond to my anger is with laughter. You have to laugh at me. And they're like, why would I laugh at somebody who's like pissed off? And I'm like, that's just the way I am. Like, it makes me feel better if you laugh at me. Like, if you see me fighting an inanimate object, you should be laughing at me. And then that makes me feel better. But if you do this, like, geez, why are you so angry? And God, you're so negative. Like, now I want you to fuck off. You know, now I'm angry, you know. But, like, if you laugh, I need to be laughed at. Not just with, I need to be laughed at, with, and made a fool of all the time. I'm not, I don't get off on somebody, you know, humiliating me. It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, interpersonally, if somebody laughs me off, it's much healthier for everyone.
I agree. I think I had to teach myself that not everything is like, like I can just laugh, like seriously, just laugh. It's fine. I know exactly where my rage comes from.
Where's your rage come from?
Listen, man, I grew up with like four older brothers. And you know, I didn't move from America. I moved to America when I was 15. So when I was in Pakistan, and when I, you know, I grew up in a really violent household, so my parents were
violent?
Just incredibly violent.
Violent how?
Like, my dad used to beat the living daylights out of my mother. And not just that, but he would also take turns beating the shit out of us. And as I got older, dad started turning his anger from my mother to me. So he would like beat the shit out of me. He would like beat the living hell out of me. So, I mean, literally 2 months before I moved to the US, my dad and my mom got into a fight. I became the middle fucking child liaison because all my brothers had already moved to America. So then I'm in the middle of a fight, and then I'm left in the middle. And then my father, because he doesn't want to take the anger out of my mom, like grabbed me by my hair and like started bashing my head in the wall. And he's like beating the fucking pulp out of me. So then you're like, oh shit, like this is really fucked up. Like this is a really, and as a kid, like you don't understand. You like, you have an immense amount of low self-esteem. You grow up, you're just like, I guess this is just how families are. I remember being in eighth grade and going to class and asking my classmate, I was like, so how often does your dad beat your mom? And she goes, what the fuck are you talking about? And I was like, how often does your dad beat your mom? Isn't that like a normal thing? She's like, no, that is completely fucking abnormal. I was like, oh, I think I might have grown up in a dysfunctional family.
Yeah, that's actual real trauma. That's real emotional trauma right there.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I know where it comes from. I mean, look, I've worked on it like a great deal. I feel I don't have the urge to pick up a gun and go on a shooting spree, so that's good. but you know, so those, like, I've been working on those things. So, but I know where my rage comes from. But you know, it's interesting because I feel like, I don't know if this is true for you, but when you get in those really kind of fucked up headspace place where you're like, you feel like emotionally, you're like backed in a corner, all my creativity just starts like flowing out of me. Does that happen to you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sometimes it's useless and sometimes it isn't. But like, let me ask you this. If through all of your years of therapy, do you have a picture of who you would be without the violence in your house, the domestic violence? Like, so in other words, do you have rage naturally as part of your wiring, or is it more, you know, nature? I mean, nurture. Is it more environment?
I think it might be. It might have been maybe a mix. Like, my mom is probably more like on the chill side. My dad is the one with the temper, or was with the temper. So I feel like I'm a lot more like my dad than my mother. So I definitely got my dad genes, but I think like the nurturing didn't help either. So, you know, and it wasn't just like my dad that was doing the physical abuse. When I moved to the US, my brothers were taking turns beating the shit out of me. So it was just like this kind of perpetual cycle of like, you know, hate and violence. And you're just like, I don't understand. Like, none of this makes sense to me. So, you know, I think the single greatest thing I ever did for myself is go to therapy. Cause I mean, otherwise, you know, it's like you start fantasizing crazy shit. You're just like, I'm going to do damage to some people. Right? Right. Before I get in that mode, let me go get some therapy.
Yeah, yeah, because you don't know what's real or what's normal sometimes, maybe, because the way you were raised, you're constantly probably looking and going, well, maybe I didn't get the syllabus on life. Maybe I'm supposed to act some other way, or you're sort of basically confused. But
yeah,
I don't know where that comes. I mean, look, if your dad probably was raised in a similar situation where
he grew up with a lot of abuse too. He grew up with so much abuse, and he was just, you know, you just kind of, back then, there's no like awareness. There's no like, oh, let me go to therapy and work the shit out. It's like, my family to this day, like, resists going to therapy. I'm the only person in my family who goes to therapy. And, you know, back to your question, have I ever imagined what I would be like without that? I don't. I've never actually imagined that. That's a really good question. Is that a therapy question?
Well, it's just like, if you could separate yourself from the way you were raised and just, you know, decide who it is that you know, what your nature is, you probably would find that you still have some fire and some anger and some maybe not to a degree that you have, but, you know, like, I have anger and I can relate to anger, and I like comics who are angry, and I don't even watch comedy. I'd rather watch drama and serious shit when I'm watching. Well, I finished Netflix already, and Hulu and Amazon. I finished all of it. I've watched everything you could possibly stream. Fucking watched it.
What about Disney point. Plus? What about Disney Plus?
Finished it. Finished all of it.
HBO Max?
All of it. Yep. HBO, Cinemax, Showtime, all of it. I've finished everything. I have no need for any of it.
All of it. Aaron, that's a lot of stuff. What do you mean all of it?
I've watched 15 million hours. But the truth is, so I have anger. I can relate to anger. I prefer to watch dramas and heavier horror. You know, I don't watch happy stuff. I don't, you know, I prefer darkness. I like the edginess. And I was raised in a family. My parents are still in love. We had a picture perfect family. Like, we really did. Yeah. I was third culture, sort of misplaced. Like, I always felt like I didn't fit in with this group or that group. Didn't fit in with the Arabs or the white people. I didn't fit in. You know, I never had a place. I was always like, I'm not totally among these people. You know, I never had a group that I belong to until I became sort of an artist. And you're like, okay, I belong to this, to the artist hive kind of mind of we all feel that way in a sense that we didn't belong or were misfits. So, and but the misfit part of me was because there's these Mormons and there's Muslims. These are, there's not two religions in the United States that are more misunderstood than those two. To be honest, Mormons are more misunderstood than Muslims these days. You ask a regular fucking person, and by regular person, I mean white. What's the first thing that comes in their head when you say Muslim? No, Persians, Hamas, Shiites. You know, they'll just say some random shit. If you say, ask Mormons, same question, Mormons, they might say missionaries or, you know, the original prophet of the Mormons was Joseph Smith, but they always called John Smith. They always mispronounce something or they have it wrong, or they'll point to that temple down in San Diego, or, you know, but they don't know anything about the Mormons.
That's true. That's true. I mean, this is like just the crazy stereotype from that movie, from the show Big Love. Remember Big Love on HBO?
Yeah, I watched that a little bit.
Remember? And that was all about, you know, Mormon. It was about sister wives is what came to my mind. And when I went to the Walmart in Zion, I saw sister wives. And that was the first time I saw something so up close like that. And I was like, wow, this is like a real thing here.
How did you know that that's what you were seeing?
I don't know. Like, they were dressed exactly alike, had the same haircut, like that kind of compound living lifestyle. So I don't know if they were actual sister wives, but they kind of had that weird, you know, it's that stupid stereotype, right? It's like the stereotype of what you're like, oh, Mormons and that. And you're like, I met other people that were Mormons and they were like, I was talking to this one bartender and I was like, are you Mormon? He goes, yeah. And I was like, and I said, what about the multiple wives thing? Is that a common thing? He goes, no. He goes, that's an old thing. That's not, he's like, no, that's not a typical thing. That's a very rare thing. I was like, oh, see, there you go. Yeah. You educated me about something. I didn't know that.
It is rare. I mean, there are communities of polygamists, but they live outside the culture of Mormonism. Like, there's these little towns, and you'll see them. They'll have, like, these women that look like they've never cut their hair their whole life. They'll have this hair down their body, and they'll put it in a braid or ponytail, and they'll have the skirts that look like they were made at home, you know, with denim or something, and they go all the way to their ankles, and, like, you know, it's almost Amish looking, you know, clothes without the bonnets and the old fashioned part, but it just hand sewn clothes and hair that just never has a style. It's just long and no makeup and that kind of stuff. But you never know. But those polygamous sects, they got pushed out of the Mormon church. The Mormon church officially stopped it. Because when Utah wanted to become a state, that was part of the deal. It was like, you guys have to give up the polygamy.
Right, right. Exactly. And that's exactly what this guy was telling me too. When you were growing up, were you guys like pretty kind of, you know, were you guys going to Mormon church like every Sunday? Was that like a big part of were you growing up or not really?
Yeah, we had to go to church every Sunday. There was church. It was always a fight. You know, had to wear ties and church clothes. And, but the way I felt about it, and I think at least two of my brothers, not the oldest one, he has resentments about it, but, we just saw it as normal American church Sunday, you know, almost traditional Americana, you know. It was like, you go to church and then you come home and watch some football and have dinner and do your homework. It wasn't a conflict for me growing up, other than the fact that I can't remember an age where I ever bought into it. Like, even at my earliest, youngest, most impressionable age, my brothers and I were snickering in the back going, this is fucking horse shit. Like, we were 6 years old. Like, wow. We were so cynical. We never believed. I don't know why we were like this. Sorry. We were so cynical as kids. We would go to church and we would just make fun of everybody and just laugh at them and their hair and everything. And you know, as soon as we got old enough, we were like, we're out of there. We're not part of this. This is not us. This is not who we are. And at one point, I think it was Christmas or something with family thing, and my parents or my mom became a big atheist, and my one of my brothers says, if you guys had been atheists all these years, why did you make us go to church? And my dad says, well, I just wanted you guys to have something you could reject.
What?
Yeah, he's like, I didn't want you going around looking for religion. I wanted to give you the basics, and then you could reject it. But if I didn't give you any religion, then you'd probably go out looking for a system of a belief system. And I'm like, that's actually probably right, because there was a time where I did reject the Mormons. And then I started kind of looking to find if I was, and I found out that I'm just not, I don't have a spiritual, just like everything else in my life, I'm inconsistent. I can't consistently believe in God. I can't consistently believe, I mean, I have consistencies, but I'm just saying I can't, there's not a dogma that I could subscribe to consistently. And I can't, I change my mind about a lot of stuff, you know, and I want to stay open to things. I just can't do it. It's like I think genetically some people aren't made to believe. And I'm not saying I don't believe. I'm just saying I can't believe every day. You know what I mean? And I'm not like all of a sudden I'm in a foxhole and I'm down on my luck and now I believe in God. That's not how I do it. But I'm skeptical and I'm cynical and I have had to figure out how to balance that with, you know, love and real relationships and try not to be so cynical all the time. Kids help right. you with that, but I'm still the same person. So you strip everything away and you find out that like that voice in my head is really me. It's not somebody else. It's not, you know, it wasn't because of the way I was raised. It's real. And to me, I feel confident about who I am. I'm not confused, but right. But yeah, there was no way I was going to go to the Catholics or convert to Judaism or Islam or anything else. I mean, I tried Islam. I have too many crazy family members. It's political. You know, it's like, it's not the religion. It's the culture that screwed up the religion, not the yeah. religion that screwed up the culture, you know?
Thing is, Aaron, also a lot of Muslims are not very educated about the history of Islam and how political Islam is so heavily intertwined also with the faith. I mean, what a lot of people don't know historically, and some people might even consider sacrilege, but Prophet Muhammad was not just a prophet. He was also a brilliant politician. I mean, he united the people of Quraysh. The people of Quraysh were brutal to each other. They were murdering and slaughtering each other. And then Prophet Muhammad came along and was just like, dude, we got to put our weapons down. We got to come together. We can't constantly be killing each other. Because there were multiple religions that were coming up at the same time. Right. But a lot of people don't know that. I mean, Prophet Muhammad didn't have that kind of, you know, he went up to the mountain and for 40 days, God spoke to him. Yes, yes, there's that aspect. But he didn't have that kind of... you know, that kind of Moses thing where it was just like, I'm going to part the Red Sea. Like Prophet Muhammad wasn't pulling in miracles like that. You know what I'm saying?
Actually, yeah. Well, Moses was a doubter. Moses was a skeptic. Moses was like, why? I don't want to do that. And God kept having to argue and tell him to do it.
Yeah.
Prophet Muhammad was much more confident in his convictions than Moses. In the way I read it. But, you're right.
40, right? Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad didn't get prophesied till he was 40. So for 40 years, he was just going about living his life like a regular dude.
Well, yeah, and he had a crazy life, but he had some serious leadership skills, and the political part of the religion with the prophet was he's like, look, if we all stop fighting amongst ourselves, and we stand together, we can stop these outsiders, these colonizers, and all the outsiders from coming in, and he did. I mean, then that's what happened. You know, there was no more of these. I mean, because you know, for 500 years before the prophet, creates this religion, Crusades and Inquisition and Roman Empire converting to Christianity and burning witches at the stake. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff going on, and they all had to go to the Middle East and try to conquer. And so it did make a lot of sense for the Prophet to say, look, we all need to be brothers in Islam, and we can stop these outsiders from meddling in our areas. So and it worked, and it worked for a long, long time. But right. The people that opposed the Prophet in his time were Saudis. I mean, those were the ones who ran him out of Mecca, and then he came back as the Prophet, and then they all converted, but then they still have fucked the religion up. You know what I mean? It's them. It's not.
Wahhabism is the cancer to Islam. Like any logical Muslim who actually knows the teachings and the history of Islam would agree with that, you know.
At the end of the day, like, I'm not a historian, I'm not any of this, but almost every religion was founded on good principles and built on the tradition that came before them. And none of it was bad, but it was that the religion today, it's especially, Islam's a good example because the book is the book, you know. It's not like Christianity where they've rewritten it from Latin to Greek to this to from Hebrew to that, you know. It's like the Quran was written in Arabic, and it's all there. There's not missing books and missing pages, and I mean it's a complete set that hasn't changed since the beginning. My point is that almost all religion is antiquated at this point.
I agree with that. I would definitely agree with that.
It's tough. It's tough to subscribe. Even the Mormons. Mormons were only created in the 1830s and 40s. And even looking back today to you know, what was that, 170 years? Like, even that's like antiquated. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
I mean, talk about crazy. You could say a lot of crazy shit about a lot of religions, but nothing's fucking weirder than the Mormons. I mean, that is a phony crock of horse shit right there.
Listen, Aaron, I think every religion has its share of like what the fuck moments where you're like, oh, this is weird. That's totally weird. I actually wanted to ask you, and who was I talking to? Who had passed the con? I forget the committee. Oh, I was talking to Felicia Michaels. I don't know if you know who she is.
Yeah.
Felicia Michaels. I had her on, and we were talking. And you know, I wanted to actually ask you: did Mitzi pass you at the Comedy Store?
Yeah,
she did.
Yeah, actually, yeah. When she died, we were all at the Comedy Store for her Comedy Store funeral, and me and I guess John Caparulo and Tripoli and I think Brett Ernst, Sebastian, Maz, and then there was a few years after me. And we were all kind of the last group that got past at the Comedy Store the old fashioned, the old traditional way, that where Mitzi watched you and passed you and right. gave you spots, you know. And then somewhere around 2006 or 8 or 9, somewhere around there is when it was like they were saying it was her, but she wasn't able to sit there and watch comics and pass them, you know. And all that. It was Tommy, and now it's Adam.
By the way, I can't see your face, Aaron. I don't know if you moved the camera. I don't know what you did, but it's kind of...
You can't see my face?
No, it's like stuck in a... Let me try something here. All right, there you are. There you are. I got like stuck. It was like on top of your hair. That's all I could see. I just feel like... Do you feel like if you had not went to the Comedy Store, gotten past by Mitzi, that the Axis of Evil world tour, comedy tour, would have never come into existence?
It might not have. I mean, it really might not have. I mean, it was
Mitzi was way ahead of her time. Like, she was doing diversity and all that before it became even any kind of conversation that it's become in the past 5 years. So Mitzi was doing this way ahead of time.
Yeah, matter of fact, I don't know if I would have been paid regular if Mitzi wasn't looking for like Middle Eastern comedians, you know, because like that was always something that I did in my act. But I'd started before 9/11, so I wasn't sure how long I was good. I wasn't sure how much water I was going to get out of that well, you know, being Arab. I knew being Arab and Mormon was part of my identity on stage. To me, it was like, nobody else has my background. I'll be able to separate myself somehow. I'll be distinctive somehow. But I still knew that I wasn't going to be able to just talk about Mormons and Muslims like all the time. I had to be funny. I had to just be a comic. And I was there because I had gone to acting school and figured out that I was funnier than I was anything else and that I did want to perform. And so my motivation to become a comic had nothing to do with being Arab and Mormon and all that. It was just the way I was wired. But once I decided, hey, I do want to try to do this, what would I talk about? It was like right in front of me. I was like, oh, well, I'll talk about that. That'd be good, you know? And so I did.
Yeah.
But then obviously the 9/11 changes everything.
Yeah.
And but Mitzi found us and wanted Middle Eastern voices before 9/11.
Oh, before 9/11 hit, you guys I see. So it was you, Maaz, who else? Who else passed the Comedy Store around that time?
And Ahmed.
Ahmed. Ah.
Yeah. So he was producing shows around Hollywood already. Maaz was already a paid regular. I had met Maaz at the Ha Ha Cafe and we had connected. And I had already showcased for Mitzi, actually. But she didn't remember me because I'd been in the belly room for a year.
Okay.
And so all of a sudden somebody says, hey, she's looking for like Middle Eastern comedians. And I'm like, oh, what? You know? And then I go down there. My name is on the list. And under my name, it says Maaz Jobrani. So he had sponsored me. He had recommended me, you know, to Mitzi.
Wow.
So that helped me a lot. But, she, you know, Tripoli was part of that because he's Armenian. But
that's right. I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, Tripoli didn't have that much interest in, like, because we all had, like, Middle Eastern jokes, and he was forced to try to write some. He has no idea about, he does now, but at the time, like, he knew he was Armenian, but he didn't know anything about being Armenian, you know,
right?
Or Armenians. And Sebastian and Brett Ernst got thrown in that. She just thought anybody Mediterranean kind of looking was, like, you know. So it was a struggle.
Maniscalco is Italian from Chicago.
I don't know. If you asked him, he'd probably remember it. He'd do whatever show you asked him to do, you know. He wasn't gonna argue about it. But but if it weren't for Mitzi, I would have met Maaz, obviously, and at some point I would have met Ahmed. But we wouldn't have bonded as fast as we did, and we wouldn't have been put in a incubator the way she did, where she was like, you three, go to San Diego, do shows at the La Jolla Comedy Store, go to the Bellarine. She always put the three of us together and made us perform together, and it was pretty easy to see what she was trying to get us to do, and because Maaz is a good business guy, and Ahmed was already a great promoter of shows, you know, it was pretty clear what we needed to do was to try to get Middle Eastern audiences, which we didn't know if we could, and we didn't know if they existed, but that all changed, you know?
Which they did, right? I mean, I think the interesting thing is, I mean, as a producer, I've learned this. You know, the last show that you did, Aaron, I met John Geary's, who, thanks to you, I've become really good friends with, and he's just such a wonderful human being. I've had him on my live stream here and we had a great conversation. But the interesting thing is that a lot of people underestimate like ethnic communities and their buying power. Like, you know, Middle Eastern communities have a big buying power, but until you give them what is it that they need, you're not gonna be able to get that buying, you know, you're not gonna be able to get the ticket money. You know, you're not getting that ticket sale. And after I did the last show with you, I figured something out. And I did a show at the same venue that you came to in Irvine. And we packed the room out with 300 South Asian women.
Wow.
So it's like, okay, so all this time I was doing all these mixed, you know, like mixed dudes and mixed girls and stuff like that. And the moment I made it all female, all these women came out. And it was like, whoa, I didn't know there was a demand for this. Like, I didn't know there was a demand. You know,
there's always an underserved, there's always a group that's underserved. And look, I know a lot of people, a lot of comics, a lot of people around comedy, they hate themed comedy nights in any direction, whether it's fat or women or gay or whatever. They don't like the idea of a night of this type of, you know, ethnic comedian or type of, you know, which I understand, because look, at the end of the day, we all have to be comedians first, and our culture and our, you know, orientation, whatever it is, comes, that's secondary to our ability on stage. But in our case, our specific case of Muslims and Arabs and, you know, and South Asians, I mean, there was Russell Peters, there's like,
sure,
I guess at the early on, he was probably the only one, but, speaking for myself, it was like Muslims and Arabs didn't have anyone. There was nothing. And there was obviously an inciting incident that forced us all to say, hey, we're Americans and we buy the same things as you do. And we want to be, we don't like terrorists either, you know. Yeah. And there was this need to sort of speak up for ourselves and say what we had, what we stood for as American Arabs, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. And so that all became sort of the thing where I just said, I don't give a fuck what comedians are going to say about themes this and themes that, because we're not fat night. We're not gay night. We are Muslims doing comedy after 9/11. Like, you know, this is different. This is our show became a cultural event, not just a comedy show. It became like this, a thing, you know. And then we go to the Middle East and it was even bigger. We were even bigger out there. So, you know, it became this international sort of thing. And it was, obviously it was great for our business, but I still would have probably written the same jokes, because I didn't, early on we said, we're not going to talk about terrorism because that's like, you know, we don't want to, perpetuate negative stereotypes. But then 9/11 happens and you kind of have to acknowledge that. And every year there was something else that you kind of had to acknowledge. It was a thorny, very hard sort of road to balance on as a comic, because you had a responsibility to talk about some social, political, you know, global issues. But that fit for me, and Maz also was a poli-sci major, and you know, so we didn't really have a problem with it. We went right down that rabbit hole. But without 9/11 and without Mitzi, we all would be still doing comedy and talking about being Muslims and Arabs. It just wouldn't have maybe the pressure on it, or the audience wouldn't feel the need to support us, because they, you know, like you see like Rami's show on Hulu.
Yeah,
it just sort of pops up, and nobody realized like an Arab and a Muslim's never had his own show. Like, it's never happened.
That's right. And
Rami's done great, because he, instead of having to educate an audience, like, you know, you and I, when we started, we had to explain what Muslims were and
sure
what the difference between Asia and South Asia was. Like, there was so much infotainment you had to do before you could even get to the fucking jokes. Rami skipped all that, and he just went right to the, you know, to the interpersonal psychoanalyzing, depressed, you know, jerking off.
But the reason Rami chose to do that is because of Aaron Cater and Ahmed Ahmed and Maz Jikrani and Russell Peters, and the groundwork has been laid out for him, for so it's not so much like I have to do all this back work explaining it. Even, you know, you have to understand the executives are also feeling comfortable, because culturally it's been more accepted because of people like yourself.
Yeah, that's true. It's, you know, Rami and I have talked about that too. It's like he wouldn't have been able to do this 10 years ago. And And we kind of we thought, like, we always thought that a show like his was going to happen or was a possibility, but you know, it takes the right person to do that, which was Rami, and it takes the right not necessarily the right time, but just the right person to pull that off.
And Rami also has a very sweet disposition, right? He's like a born and raised Jersey guy. He's like a non-conflict guy. He's got like a little very like non-confrontational, very sweet disposition. You're like,
he's a super, super likable, super positive. Yeah. And he's very also he's very, very sweet, and he's multi-talented too. He's not just a comedian or just, you know, he does a lot of different things. He not just can write jokes and perform, but really good at producing, writing scripts. And, but even before all of that, he was a connector guy. He was one of these guys who everybody knew somebody who knew him, and he would call me and he'd go, "Hey, let's go to this movie." And I'd be like, "All right." And then we'd get together and we'd go to the theater and there'd be like 15 people there. And I'd be like, "Oh, I didn't know this was like a group thing." Like, anytime you do anything with Rami, it's a group thing. It's like 25 fucking people, you know? He's like, he's a connector guy. He's a hub. He's a, what do you call it? He's a good networker. So he's really good at getting people together and doing things and pulling things off. But, obviously without everything that came before him with Arabs and stuff in comedy, who knows how different it would be for him.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, everybody, all of us have like some kind of, I think you guys were definitely more on the trailblazing end. I think I feel I'm a little bit also on the trailblazing end because there aren't any South Asian female comedians that are
true.
Everybody keeps calling Mindy Kaling a comic. I swear to God, I'm going to blow my fucking lid. She is not a stand-up comic. She's a comedic actress. She's a writer. She's never done stand-up. No, she's not a stand-up comic. So I don't know why people keep saying that. So
she's a comedic actress and she's had success and she's South Asian.
Yeah. Yeah. So they keep calling her a stand-up comic. And it's like, no, she's not a stand-up comic. Trust me. Wait. Right. I have a whole slew of stand-up comics that are South Asian females. She is not that, but I feel like I was watching actually John Geary's told me about a documentary you did in 2018 called Make America Laugh Again.
There were some filmmakers that were making a movie. They were trying to make a documentary.
Uh-huh.
And you know how documentaries are, it's hard to make a documentary because you don't know what the plot is. You know, it changes as you get more footage and interview more people and dig up more stuff. So at the end, after they interviewed all these Middle Eastern and Muslim comedians, they ended up doing a lot with me and then kind of making me the poster boy of the movie. But it wasn't my film. It was just they used me as a focal point to do other things in the film. But yeah, it was a response to the Trump, you know, Muslim ban, and which seems so long ago now, but it does.
Brutal. The first 100 days were brutal. But they were brutal, what he was going to doing.
Yeah, I remember every morning I'd wake up, and as soon as my feet hit the ground, I'd go, "Oh yeah, fuck, this guy's president." Like, I couldn't. It was so hard to get used to, and then you just saw it coming. You're like, his cabinet. It was like, he is stocking up on nuts. And then it was the Muslim ban. And then it was, you know, the border. And then it was just one bad thing after the other. And we're just like living in this daily, daily outrage, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I thought that Make America Laugh Again was your doc. And I was just like, oh, this is so great. What have you been like during the pandemic? Have you been writing scripts? Like, what are you kind of keeping yourself busy with besides taking care of the babies?
Well, so I've always cooked and I always enjoyed it because it was like, if I'm cooking, then I don't have to be with the kids and I don't have to do it. Like, I'm cooking. I'm doing this for you, you know? And there's a sense of accomplishment when you like try something new and you cook it and you do it well. Yeah. So there was a lot of things that I wanted to do, and I had been talking about bread for a while, and then the pandemic hit, and I was like, well, I'm going to start cooking bread. So I got really into the bread, cinnamon buns and sourdoughs and all kinds of different stuff. Right. And that kept me busy. But the kids, it's like, I don't, like, I had a dream that I was going to jerk off. Like, not a dream that I was going to have sex with some hot girl. Not a dream that I was with my wife alone. No, I had a dream that everybody left the house. And in my dream, I was like, oh, I might be able to jerk off, you know? And no, but I didn't. And I didn't jerk off in the dream. It woke me up. It made me so angry that I was dreaming that it woke me up. And I was like, I can't believe I just had a dream that I was thinking about jerking off. Like, what kind of a fucking life am I living, right? So I don't have time to do shit. And even when I do have, like, I can kind of cook and I can do stuff. And a lot of this for the kids, you know, we're making cookies and doing things like this. But a lot of it is I can't do anything for more than maybe 1 hour.
Yeah.
Max, yeah. Without having to be on duty and do something else. So it's been pretty difficult. Like I've thought about, you know, should I be writing? Should I have finished the script? Should I have? But I can't even fucking think straight, honestly. And the last thing I was going to do is start a fucking podcast. Like, do we need one more comic during a goddamn podcast? Like, and beside the fact, I don't have time to even sit for a couple of hours, like even in the garage. Like right now, Susie's here to help. But otherwise, yeah. I don't think we could talk this long.
Yeah. I mean, you can try to do like your podcast. Yes, we do need another comedian podcast because there's a lot of bullshit podcasts out there that nobody cares about. So you definitely have a lot more valuable things to add than most of the fucking people on doing podcasts. And second, like, what if you just do it once a week? Just had Auntie Susie come over and just dedicate 2 hours and just like rock it out.
Yeah, well, I am talking about it, but I think I'll focus on maybe parenting and autism and some of the other things, you know, that I don't see a lot of that stuff on podcasts, but like, I can't just get on a podcast and bullshit because I feel like that's just so what everybody's doing. And I don't.
Well, no, not bullshit. It has to be focused. It has to be focused for sure. No. I don't believe. I mean, look, I live stream 5 days a week. Okay. Each one of my episodes is focused 5 days a week, 2 hours a night, every single night. Aaron.
Hey, if I could. Even if I could get on and bullshit for an hour every day, I would, but I just, it's too late now to all of a sudden try to launch something when it's like every comic has to be online now anyway. So now I think the pressure's on me to be like, I have to do something different because, I mean, I've done a lot of podcasts before and it's hard to separate yourself from so many.
Well, you know, it's like, have you heard, do you know who David Arnold is? The comedian, David Arnold?
Oh, yeah, Dave Arnold. Yeah, I know Dave Arnold.
He does this whole thing with his family, and, like, people love watching family stuff.
Right.
They love watching family stuff. Oh, my daughters, did you hear what my daughter just said? And people love hearing shit like that. So
I haven't seen Dave Arnold in forever. I'll have to look that up and see what he's doing.
Yeah, oh, my God, dude, he's killing it on his Instagram. Like, he has so many followers and stuff. And people love watching family shit. Like, you know, I wonder if you can focus it on your kids somehow, or, you know, focus it. People love watching other people's babies. Apparently, that's like
their. Yeah, and obviously, I mean, parents can relate to this stuff. But I've written a ton of jokes just about them. You know, just sitting around here, where it's like, you know, child services should. Impeach me or something. I take the kids away. Like, if child services showed up, I'd be like, do I go with you or do they go with you? Because
you're like,
all of our bags are packed either way.
Leave the kids, take me.
I got that. And what was the other thing? I was I should have had my list of jokes. I was too jammed up. But no, I keep writing and I keep putting ideas down, but, you know, we just don't know when this shit's going to end and when we're actually going to be able to, like, can you imagine the release that is going to happen when we are free to go and do shows again, and the audiences are going to be so excited.
Oh, it's going to be crazy, Aaron. I mean, we're going to pack the rooms out. Speaking
people
of
have money,
people with money. Oh, I don't know if you heard, but Moderna just got the FDA approval today, so that's the second vaccine that's going in. So, and the Moderna vaccine, I think, has a lot. It's a lot easier to manage than the Pfizer vaccine. So, I think this is going to be a huge boost to the economy. But I wanted to ask you: did you go to John Geary's comedy club yet? The stand-up comedy club in Bellflower?
No, him and I, we seem to text like once a month, and he keeps sending me pictures, and we had a whole plan to do shows there, but then this thing happened. Yeah.
It's a beautiful club. Like
I went down there when it was under construction, and I saw the pictures, and he sent me the pictures too. Yeah, it actually looks amazing.
I mean, I was the first stand-up to. He invited me to come in, like kind of pop the comedy cherry, whatever, of the club. So I went over, and he was like, "You're the first comic to step on that stage." I'm like, "Oh, dude, I'm so honored." Yeah, it was great. It's great. The club was
fantastic.
So the moment thing. All this bullshit goes away the moment the pandemic goes away. Minority Reports is going to be actually officially at the stand-up.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, so I'm very, very excited about that.
You're going to keep it on Thursdays?
We're probably going to keep it on Thursdays. Yeah, we're more than likely going to keep it on Thursdays.
Well,
I know.
Go ahead.
I know I've taken an hour and 11 minutes of your time, so we're going to wrap up.
When we can do this and when things are back on track, we should put our heads together and do one big show at his club, or maybe the whole weekend, because he's gonna need help getting that place cooking.
I'm totally down. Aaron, where can people follow you? Are you active on social media? Are you putting out stuff if people want to follow you?
I haven't had anything to say, but I end up on Twitter more often. I don't know why, but at Aaron Cater. It's Aaron with one A, by the way. A-R-O-N.
Aaron.
Aaron. So at Aaron Cater. I haven't been on Facebook in forever. I can't stand it. And I don't do Instagram much either, because I can't stand it. I don't want to see fucking any of you shit fucking people with your fucking pictures. I don't care.
I don't
give a fuck. The only reason I'm there is because I'll get fined if I don't.
I get it. Aaron, always a pleasure talking to you, my friend. Stay safe out there. Happy holidays.
Thanks for having me on. Mona, thanks for thinking of me always. And it's great to see you. It's great to see anybody, but you look fantastic.
Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon. All right. Take care.
All right, my friend. See you.
Bye. That was a lovely Aaron Cater. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I know I definitely did. Sorry, it was a little choppy because and in Aaron's defense, he is taking care of two kids. So I totally give him, he is completely pardoned for anything. So, you guys, this has been a long freaking week. Can you live stream for money when you do MR? James asks, when can you, I don't know that, we might be able to possibly work something out for that, but good idea, James. Thank you for that. All right. Well, I am exhausted. I have another comedy show to do after this. If you want to watch me there, you can go to comedyoakland.com. I'm going to be doing a set very shortly at 7:30 today. You can watch me there. You guys, I will see you on Monday. Have a good night. Thank you very much for tuning in, James.